Welcome to History 605, South Dakota State Historical Society's podcast, where we talk to historians, curators, filmmakers, artists, and authors about how they interpret the past.
10,000 years from now, I think we can meditate and wonder whether our descendants, because I think they'll still be here, what they will think about us. And let us hope that at least they will give us the benefit of the doubt.
I'm Dr. Ben Jones, South Dakota State Historian and Director of the State Historical Society. Join me and our guests as we think historically.
So it is most appropriate and fitting that in our first year of our second century that this should also be a year of reconciliation between the Indian people and the non-Indian people alike.
History 605 is sponsored by the Gruver Family Trust and done in partnership with South Dakota Public Broadcasting. Welcome to the show.
Welcome to History 605. Today, Brayden and I are going to talk about a little-known military unit from South Dakota. In fact, it's appropriately titled the First South Dakota. The First South Dakota Volunteers is the unit we're talking about, which was raised in 1898. Brayden, welcome to History 605. Thanks for helping me out today.
Yeah, of course. It's awesome to be here.
Yeah, this is a little-known unit from a little-known aspect of a little-known war. It's kind of one of those out-of-the-way stories that is really, when you dig into it, well, it's pretty darn fascinating. People in South Dakota should know more about the First South Dakota Volunteers. So this should be a good discussion.
Yeah, I think a lot of people have maybe in passing heard of the Spanish-American War. I don't know how many people have heard of the Filipino-American War.
You have Spain, and then the war is really touched off about Cuba. And then on the other side of the planet is the Philippines. So context is king in all of these things. Why in the 1890s does the United States, what's the beef that the United States has with Spain?
There had been a revolt happening in Cuba throughout the 1890s, and Spain is cracking down on it and fighting this ongoing prolonged civil war. It's affecting industry in the United States and trade. But also there is the press is getting into it, kind of national American press. So led by William Randolph Hearst and Joseph Pulitzer. Right. They're rallying support for the rebels there in Cuba.
Right. And for listeners of the podcast, we just talked about the Hearst family a few podcasts ago about the mine, the Homestake mine. So this is the same family. So this William Randolph Hearst is George Hearst's son who begins a publishing empire. And he is explaining the tensions, the fighting, the politics of what's going on in Cuba. By the way, this is also covered by a young military reporter by the name of Winston Churchill from Britain. he's in 1895, he's sent over to Cuba to cover the war for the British newspapers. And he writes tons of gripping commentary and colorful copy for the British newspapers. So that's kind of the interest. That there's interest in Europe. There's interest certainly in Spain, certainly interest in the United States and what's going on in Cuba. And the United States has since the end of the Civil War, and there's been from time to time efforts to annex Cuba or to buy Cuba from the Spanish. That has gone nowhere. And then with all this tension going on and so forth, the United States in February of 1898, sends one of its premier warships into the Havana Harbor. It's kind of a statement to say the United States is paying attention. And it explodes, sinks, as it's sitting there at the dock, killing 268 sailors. And the American people are pretty darn upset.
Pretty darn upset might be an understatement.
Yeah.
And so it simmers for a little while longer, but eventually in April, there will be the declaration of war with Spain, and that'll kick off the Spanish-American War.
Right. And the president, William McKinley, has attempted to kind of come to some kind of agreements with the Spanish to support the Cubans, but not get too involved. And then when the Maine explodes, the writing is kind of on the wall after that. And with Hearst in there just whipping up wartime fever and McKinley has a young assistant secretary of the Navy by the name of Theodore Roosevelt, who is very much an advocate for war with Spain, and he does something. And this is what brings the Philippines into the picture. He sends some orders to the fleet around the world. And this kicks off the event that brings the Philippines into the picture. What was that?
Right. The Navy goes into Manila Harbor and
yes.
just crushes the Spanish fleet there. I think not even a chance. Not even a chance for the Spanish.
No, there's a few hours, maybe a couple of days of negotiations after some, you know, like the presence, the U.S. fleet arrives, the Spanish naval fleet commander, well, he has to save face, right? He can't just kind of roll over. So they agree to take some shots and then retreat. Then they're going to throw the white flag up and retreat and or surrender. United States accepts the surrender. And who's the admiral, by the way? This is Dewey, right? Admiral Dewey, who was in the fleet. His ships are in Hong Kong. When he gets the message from Roosevelt, he steams, makes a beeline from Hong Kong to Manila, and catches the Spanish fleet, and then winds up achieving the surrender of the Spanish fleet. And now the war is kind of global. Now we go from the Caribbean to the Western Pacific.
Right, because I think listeners have to remember that during this time, Spain is still a global empire.
Yep.
Their holdings in Cuba and the Philippines. It's
Puerto Rico, Guam.
Puerto Rico, right. Mm-hmm. So this isn't just declaring war on Spain is not declaring war and only fighting in Cuba. It's all of these places.
Yeah, at least if you ask Theodore Roosevelt, that's what it is.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. So this will lead to Congress passing legislation that increases the military size, commensurate with a war that would be fought on two fronts, with the understanding that we'll be fighting in Cuba as well as fighting in the Philippines.
When the Maine explodes, how big is the United States Army? 26,000 officers and men. That's
right.
It. 26,000 officers and men. And, oh, now we're going to fight a war in Cuba. You need more than 26,000 soldiers for a war just in Cuba. Not to mention the Navy and ships to get them there. And now we're adding the Philippines and maybe other places. Depends on how that transpires. So you're right. The War Department and McKinley put out the call to states to raise militia units to contribute forces. And they asked South Dakota for two cavalry regiments. And South Dakota, what's the state of the forces in South Dakota?
South Dakota's National Guard was organized as an infantry regiment.
Right.
They had a bunch of guys ready to fight and who wanted to fight. They didn't have the cavalry that the State Department was asking for, or the War Department.
War Department was asking, yes, that's right. And because of an incredible amount of epic level malfeasance in the early 1890s with our Treasury. In fact, the elected Secretary of Treasurer of the Treasury absconds the state with over $400,000 of the state's funds, which is not all of the money, but nearly all of the money. He was a banker in Redfield, I believe, and put the state's funds in his bank and other banks that he owned or had access to. And so in 1893, he leaves the country with the state's funds. And that's a whole nother podcast. We could get into that. His name is William Taylor, or we think his name is William Taylor. There's a little dispute about exactly what his name is, but William Taylor leaves the state with all of these funds. And so in the 1890s, on top of the grasshopper and the dry weather conditions that were really impeding farmers and the state's economy, the funds are just gone. And so...
Yes. Dead broke.
So among the many state obligations that goes unfunded or underfunded is the state's National Guard or state's militia.
A lot of the troops are arming themselves or the militiamen are training with personal items.
They're paying for their travel to go to their drill. They're paying for their equipment. They're buying their uniforms. They're raising funds. I mean, it's really...
It's a hodgepodge.
It really is.
It is
no way to run a guard unit, that's for sure. And in fact, the letters from the militia commanders to the governor's office, to the state's legislature, if you want a militia, you need to fund it. If you don't want a militia, then don't fund it. But this is this is insane. This is the way this is panning out. So that had been kind of going on since 1895, 1896, 1897. Every budget year, it wasn't getting funded. And then, bam, the Maine blows up in February of 1898. So that's the status of our National Guard. So when the Governor Lee gets the call from the War Department to raise two cavalry units, he says, I got one infantry unit, maybe. The War Department says, okay, we'll take your infantry unit, thank you very much. And now he's confronted with a choice. You know, one of the plum jobs would be to be the colonel of this infantry unit. But he doesn't pick the most senior person in the state's National Guard. He picks a first lieutenant, regular army, active duty first lieutenant, who's training the officer cadets in the program at South Dakota State College, as it was called at the time, or SDSU today. First Lieutenant Alfred S. Frost. And you might think, well, a first lieutenant can't command a infantry regiment, and you'd be right. So he promotes him to colonel, which is it jumps from to captain, major, lieutenant colonel to become a full colonel. Right. Four promotions on one fell swoop day, and bam, he tells Alfred Frost, you're going to raise the regiment, muster him in Sioux Falls, and get him ready to go. And he does.
Yep. There's kind of an interesting story, too, with Frost's middle name, isn't there?
Yeah, you know, we were talking about the other day. I'm not sure what his middle name is. I see that it's Alfred Sully Frost in one location, and Alfred in another location. It wasn't Sully. But he grows up at Fort Sully, and maybe more to follow, but we'll see if there's some kind of tie to his name and Fort Sully, or maybe even Alfred Sully, the general from the 1860s, who gives his name, Fort Sully, and then Sully County, to that part of South Dakota. But yeah, his name is interesting too. He has deep roots in South Dakota. So they muster in Sioux Falls. They start congregating. We have access to a published version of a diary of one of the soldiers from Mitchell.
Journal of Thomas H. Briggs.
Yes. This was published the date of that.
It's in our fall 2004 South Dakota History Journal.
Okay, fall 2004 for people to read through. And it's kind of a day-by-day blow of what Thomas Briggs did. Why he signed up a little bit, and you get a sense of the common soldier's life, going through training, mustering in, going off to Iowa to get some further training. And then, curiously, though, there's some things that happen that you'd think he'd comment on. And one of the things that I didn't see a comment about why, from his perspective, the first South Dakota, as we've said, goes to the Philippines. They don't go to Cuba. And he doesn't seem to comment on that. Did you see any comments in there about?
He does talk about how they, not specifically why they don't go to Cuba. No, he doesn't talk about that. And I wonder if, I guess I don't know. This is conjecture. Does the regular army initially go into Cuba, and the state militias are sent to kind of deal with the Philippines?
For the most part, that's the case. The regular army is more ready to go, and Cuba is the emphasis for the regular army. But of course, there are volunteer units that do go to Cuba, and that would be the one that Teddy Roosevelt is the lieutenant colonel in, the first U.S. Volunteers, or the Rough Riders, which is the nickname of the Roosevelt High School in Sioux Falls. So the connection there is a good one. There are volunteers, soldiers from South Dakota who want to get into the Rough Riders. Doesn't quite pan out that way. They're too late to get into the Teddy Roosevelt's Rough Riders.
Well, there was a second Rough Rider division that was being formed to head over to the Philippines.
Right. Seth Bullock is a part of, is the hopeful part to get into the first U.S. volunteers. But what might have become another set of volunteers from, in kind of that spirit of the Rough Riders, is Grigsby from Sioux Falls works to raise a volunteer unit kind of on the order of the Rough Riders, but that doesn't pan out. Again, the war all happened so fast, and the organization is non-existent at the beginning of the war. And so, Grigsby's Cowboys. This is Colonel Melvin Grigsby, had been no part of the state's National Guard. But in January of 1898, Grigsby, then Attorney General of the state, seeing the cowboys working through the streets of the Capitol and doing other things, and of course, aware of the Rough Riders under Colonel Theodore Roosevelt, works with the War Department to try and generate another group. All of that just is too slow. Just doesn't happen, and the war in Cuba is over by the time Grigsby is able to get that unit together.
Right. But I think what's key that you're mentioning is how many people were enthusiastic about going to war during this. And so they're volunteering wherever they can. And we see a lot of different part of the 1st South Dakota volunteers. I mean, this regiment is really made up of guys from all over the state.
Yeah, why don't you go down the company list there?
Yeah, so you have Company A from Pierre, Company B is from Sioux Falls, Company C is Yankton, Company D is Worthing, Company E is DeSmit, Company F is from Aberdeen, Company G is from Huron, and they've got kind of a funny story too there.
Yeah.
Company H is Watertown, Company I is Custer, Company K is Brookings, Company L is Spearfish, and Company M is Rapid City.
Right. So each one of these communities put together a company, which is probably around 120 men.
Right.
Starts to outfit them and so forth. And then they all meet up in Sioux Falls, get formed up, get on trains, go to Iowa. One of the first choices there is something you alluded to there. The companies in the State Guard had been used to electing their own officers. What's the governor think of electing the officers?
Believe it or not, the governor is not a fan, and all of the officers who Company G elected were rejected, failed to pass their medical exams.
Oops.
Right. So Colonel Frost, before they even get out of the state, has this problem on his hands. He's got a company who is adamant that they get to elect their officers. He kind of makes the decision for them. He tells them to go home.
Right. This is a bit of a clash of cultures between an active duty Army officer and a National Guard tradition and sense of what of how officers are chosen. Frost isn't. No, the men don't elect their officers. The governor and I appoint them. That's the way this works. And the boys from Huron don't like it, so they're relieved. They're sent back home.
And so Company G does get reorganized without the Huron fellows, but it doesn't stop the Huron paper from kind of publishing some nasty comments about Colonel Frost.
Well, another thing, too, that kind of the politics behind this, you have to realize Governor Lee won his election in 1896 by a whisker, or 0.5%. And 1898 is going to be a re-election year. At that time, South Dakota elected its governor for two-year terms. And so, and he does run for re-election. But he, I think, and as events will play out, he picks the right guy for this job to be the commander, to take this unit halfway around the world into combat. And he's reelected, but again, just by a whisker, almost the same type of percentage. So it would have been the easy thing to do to pick someone that would have been popular inside South Dakota to garner a political group or a sense of pride within South Dakotans. But he fortunately evidently realizes that, no, I need competence and I want my boys to come back.
Right.
So picks Frost, and Frost more or less fires these guys out of Huron about this commander issue, this appointing officers issue, and takes the rest of the regiment to Iowa for some training.
Right.
And then,
but before they can even leave, the state legislature hasn't appropriated enough money for the troops to get out of the state.
Yeah, here the war is a popular war, right? And the legislature still won't appropriate money for the guard unit to deploy out of the state.
So Governor Lee and I think, what is it, like nine other South Dakotans, private citizens, fundraise the remaining $15,000 that's needed to outfit the troops and actually get them on their way.
Right. Private money to use to deploy the state guard unit for a federally mandated mission. It's pretty wild. Speaking of which, let's talk a little bit about the equipment they have. Had to do a little digging about what was the common infantry rifle they would have had, and it turns out more than likely the folks at the National Guard Museum in Pierre helped out with this too. The 1873 Winchester trapdoor breech loading 45-70 caliber was the firearm they had. And this firearm, by the way, it's the same thing that Custer's group had at the Little Bighorn, which shouldn't make you feel very good, but it's, you know, single shot rifle. So you're firing one at a time. Smokeless powder is a invention that has just happened. And so some of the units in this war will have the Craig Jorgensen rifle or maybe other rifles that use smokeless powder ammunition, but not us, not the First South Dakota. So as we get into that they're using the black powder, which will help the fog of battle, I guess, will fuel that. Anyway, these guys are going to get a long cruise across the Pacific, but first they got to get themselves to San Francisco, right?
Yep. So they're riding a train, and they take that sucker through the mountains. And in Thomas Briggs' journal, he kind of goes over it, but it takes them a while to get there. It takes them a while. Yep. And once they reach San Francisco, they stay there for a bit of time to do additional drilling.
Right.
And kind training. Of familiarize themselves with the other units that they'll be working with.
Now, both in Iowa and in California, it's at Presidio, which was an army post up until about 15 years ago. The Presidio's right at the base of the south side of the Golden Gate Bridge. Anybody who's been to that part of the country before would immediately recognize the scenery there. The beauty there is impressive, and the Presidio is the place they're training. We have photographs from there. You can go online to the archival photographs, and I've seen some photographs from different antique shops in the state from time to time. You'll see Colonel Frost and his troops there drilling on a battlefield or posing for photographs. The photographs are quite striking. But so there's parades, there's a lot of training, there's drill, and you get this in Riggs's diary, the kind of day-by-day schedule and so forth. And then there's a lot of confusion about when are they leaving? Which boat are they getting on?
They get split up onto the Rio de Janeiro.
Okay. Yep.
And so they head out before, and then the first follows on the St. Paul, and they're heading to Hawaii right away.
Yeah. So a stop in Honolulu, a lot of seasickness at first. They get past that. There seems to be a great deal of concern about how much food that they have. And so rations at first are pretty low, but then after Hawaii, I think it got better. In addition to a little less seasickness as they kind of get their sea legs. And they pull into Manila in August, right? Mm-hmm. Do I have the date right? They get in that late August into the Philippines?
Yep. And they arrived in Manila August 24th. And so while they're en route to Manila on August 12th, the war with Spain ends.
The war is over. Guess what? So was their enlistment. And Governor Lee is on the horn to the War Department saying, hey, bring my boys home. The war's over. Their enlistment's done. And the War mm-hmm. Department says, yeah, but we got other plans for them. Which kind of goes back to, let's say, okay, so you're President McKinley. And now you've got a choice to make. You have a decision to make. And this is, I think, ably recounted in Brian Lynn's book on the Philippine War. Which was out some years ago, The Philippine War, 1899 to 1902 by Brian McAllister Lynn. For anybody who's interested in that, I highly recommend this book. He goes through first off, there's a lot of conjecture here because McKinley, who dies, he's assassinated in 1901 for reasons that had nothing to do with the Philippines, has to make a decision that, okay, well, the United States Congress has said, if we win the war with Spain, we are not going to annex Cuba. That's known as the Platt Amendment. And the United States just says, nope, that we are fighting this war with Spain about Cuba and with these other issues. But the result of the war will not be the annexation of Cuba, which is, you know, to the anti-imperialists in the Senate, of which there are many, and the House, that's a great accomplishment that they're able to get through. But they don't include the other things that the Spanish Empire has that are kind of up for grabs as the Spanish Empire is being defeated in this war. And one of them is the Philippines. And with the American fleet sitting in Manila Harbor and other great world powers like the Germans in particular, but the British as well, McKinley has to think to himself, well, do I take the Manila Harbor? Do I ask for just rights of port in Manila? Do I ask for just a portion of get just a portion of the Philippines from the Spanish? And in the end, probably because of pressures he's thinking and the chaos that might ensue if a Western nation doesn't take over the Philippines, he decides to annex the Philippines and Guam and Puerto Rico. But for Thomas Riggs and Colonel Frost and Governor Lee, the operative thing here is the Philippines. And that's what the War Department might need them to do, is go in and secure Manila and perhaps other parts of the Philippines. Does Thomas Riggs have much to say about this in his diary?
This kind of international
politics and diplomacy that's above his pay grade. He really doesn't seem to...
Believe it or not, you see just a lot of, it was a fine day, or it was a hot day. I mean, it's vacation. This guy is in a completely unknown world to him to this point. And so you kind of get the sense that he's soaking it in as he's, you know, the rain fell heavy during the day and most of the night. It's in the raining season. It pours torrents. You know, he goes, oh, it's a very fine day. You know, we opened up the boxes that came yesterday. They're getting some mail in. It's a great adventure, I think, is really the feeling that comes out.
That's the term that came to my mind, too, is adventure. He is seeing this as an adventure of a lifetime, and indeed it was for him and for all these soldiers from Mitchell and DeSmet and Rapid City around the state who volunteered for what began as a popular war but is quickly sliding into an unpopular war more broadly across the country. But he does that, the politics of that, the popularity of it, and so forth. He's just confronted with his day-to-day and mail call and rumors and what might be happening to them, you know, the next day and the next day. It's a very localized level from his perspective. So we really don't know how he felt about any of that.
We do know that tensions are starting to rise, though, in the Philippines themselves, as the Filipinos had initially sided with the United States against the Spanish, as they're kind of coming to this understanding that, oh, we're not getting our independence. The tensions start rising, and by January, Briggs actually ends his journal, because in February, the American-Philippine War is going to kick off.
And we don't know why, because he doesn't say, I'm stopping the journal now because I'm too busy out on actions and maneuvers and combat and so forth. But we can assume that he's just too busy. He may have just been unable. He's on guard duty. He's got to guard a post, and he can't sit there and keep up with his journal and his letter writing and so forth. So, yeah, on the 4th of February, first shots are fired by a Nebraska infantry soldier adjacent to the South Dakota Volunteers, just north of Manila. They've kind of established trench lines and blockhouses are the anchors of their positions. There's kind of an argument between an armed Filipino and a Nebraska soldier. A bit of a shootout ensues, and that's the first shots in the Philippine War.
And it's awesome that you mentioned the blockhouses, because that's one of our artifacts that we carry in the museum, one of the first items accessioned to the museum.
Right. In that, in the museum is it just looks like a block of wood. But if you read the sign and the interpretation of it, in the former museum, there was a large display for the first South Dakota. It's kind of eerie to think that that's a part of the fighting position of the first South Dakota on the outskirts of Manila in February, March of 1899. This kind of touches off a series of running engagements. The Emilio Aguinaldo is the leader of the Filipino insurgents. Some Filipinos are clearly with the United States. There's units that are recruited ultimately by the American government to support U.S. Army actions, and there's Filipinos who sign up to do that, and there's Filipinos who do neither, right? This kind of starts off an ugly insurgency that the United States pursues. This is what makes it an unpopular war. The South Dakota's Senator Richard Pettigrew becomes quite animated about this in 1899, speaks out against it on the floor of the Senate, and as do others, Massachusetts Senator, I think the North Dakota Senator. There's a lot of concern about this, born out of many of them put it in terms that it's anti-American. In fact, a very famous American writer will publish article after article in the Atlantic Monthly and other places. Mark Twain comes out opposed to this war, anti-American and so forth. And this is not in keeping with the American ideals. And so, but the fighting continues and prosecuted against these units. And
the first South Dakota is kind of in the thick of it. They're in this northern campaign. Mm-hmm. So after the kind of the kickoff at La Loma Church in the Manila Trenches, I believe it's in April when they start to move out. They switch from being on the defensive to taking a more aggressive stance,
right?
Or offensive stance, excuse me.
Well, yeah, clearly, though, just by looking at the dates of when the casualties happened, the 24th of March, 23rd, 24th of March, through to the 27th, and the 27th is the day when about a dozen are killed in action on that day. That clearly is South Dakota's roughest day in the war. And by the way, there's an added detail to that, too. In during the research for this, I came across notes in our publications that Colonel Frost had donated a pocket watch to the museum. I went to look into the artifacts in the museum, and we still have that pocket watch. There it is. But of course, it no longer ticks, and it hasn't ticked since 12:37 p.m. We think p.m. could have been a.m., but I assume it's p.m. on the 27th of March, because he had to jump in the river. And I'm not sure if he's pursuing the enemy or if he's retreating. But that pocket watch has a note on it. I'll just read the note. Watch worn by Colonel Alfred S. Frost when fording the Mar-a-Lago River during the fight. It filled with water and stopped. And it's been stopped ever since. So it's a really impressive pocket watch, a large pocket watch made by Elgin Watch Company, which was a perennial or a long-standing watch company since the 1860s, I think. So yeah, there's the watch, still stopped and flooded, which is one of the reasons why today they make waterproof or water-resistant watches.
Well, hopefully we won't be diving into rivers anytime soon.
Right. Right. Well, it's not going to be. It's tucked in safely in a safe storage.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the actual kind of blow by blow or the tick-tock, as it were, of the combat is a little bit hard to discern, except for the casualty numbers and the dates associated with them. Back in the White House, the president and the War Department are concerned because of the noise that Governor Lee has made that the 1st South Dakota Volunteers will be pulled out of the line. And they are pushing regular troops to replace them. And of course, they've got to ship them across the Pacific to begin with. And so those troops arrive and then take their place in line in August, I think, of 1899 or the fall of 1899.
May is when the South Dakotans see their last combat at San Tomas and San Fernando.
And then they're allowed to go home.
Yep. They get shipped back.
Yep.
And so when they finally land in San Francisco again, we have another debacle because no one ever figured out who was going to pay to send them home.
Yeah, and evidently it's not going to be the War Department. So Governor Lee has to go to some friends and help pay for their train tickets back for them and their individual equipment, which is, again, it's just kind of unbelievable. But sure enough, they arrive in early October of that year in Aberdeen as the first stop. And guess who's there to meet them?
Who?
President William McKinley. Which is, you know, I guess I got to give the guy some style points there for showing up at these guys' welcome home parade to be welcomed home by the president himself, who credits them and congratulates them and thanks them personally for holding on to the line while replacement troops were on the way. And he expresses his thankfulness and his pride for and recounting the moment when he heard that the 1st South Dakota Volunteers would stay until regulars came to replace them. And he thanks the troops for electing to do that. So that's classy of President McKinley to do that. He, for some reason, he can't seem to come up with the money from Congress or the War Department to pay for their transportation, but he does show up to thank them in person. So, you know, that means something.
Well, and that's the first time a sitting president had visited South Dakota.
This is true. It's the first time a president had visited the state of South Dakota. It was in October of 1899 to welcome the 1st South Dakota back home. So it's a pretty good occasion to do it. Gives a great speech thanking the soldiers, as I said, for what they've done, as he should. In the end, what's the casualty count?
Yeah, so of the total 1,029 officers and enlisted troops who leave Sioux Falls, 23 were killed in action, 35 lost their life to disease, 4 die from wounds, 1 was killed in an accident, 1 drowned, 93 were wounded and survived, and 4 were listed as deserters.
Yeah. That's a pretty good casualty rate. That's nothing to sneeze at, certainly. So, but yet their compensation drama endures. I came across a note in 1909, still filing claims to get their own personal money back from their deployment, their transportation, and so forth. They hired a Washington attorney, and they're finally successful in recovering some, not all, of their costs. There's records of $12,458 going to the troops to be split amongst the companies, which can go to them after they've paid their attorney fees. So they're really mad that they've got to pay these 20% of the War Department cost recovery goes to pay a lawyer to help them get their money back. Well, what happens to Thomas Riggs?
Yeah, so Thomas eventually will settle into civilian life. He marries Anna Mary Thompson. He's working in Mitchell at the rail yard, and unfortunately he gets killed on a train yard accident, a coupling of air brakes on a passenger train. So he passes away at only 29
years old, and his pallbearers are his friends from his company. Mm-hmm. In the 1st South Dakota. Colonel Frost is well thought of within the regular army to the extent that in 1914, he's promoted to brigadier general and sent on to other duties in Ohio, I think, Michigan, around the country. Ultimately, his daughter remains in South Dakota. She's married and lives out most of her life in Vermilion. And I think that's probably the reason why. If you want to look at Brigadier General Alfred Frost's papers, you can go to the USD Special Collections Archives there on the campus at USD and look through the 2 boxes of his papers, which is something I hope to do soon. After finding all this stuff out, what do you think of the 1st South Dakota? Braden, why should we, what's rewarding about learning about them?
Yeah, well, I think for one thing, this is the first time that South Dakota is sending troops to go fight in a national war. So this is our first kind of introduction to the larger national stage during wartime. And the troops perform excellently, no small part, I think, to the decision to appoint Frost. So there's that. I think there's also value in remembering these guys, because this is a war that kind of gets overlooked.
It does.
And a conflict that people forget about. This is the start. This is the turn of the century where we're just starting to get into the 1900s. Mm-hmm. You know, we're seeing the tail end of the 1800s. So you're starting to see a change in the way that the U.S. is moving, growing into an imperial power rather than just within the confines of the continent. So there's plenty of reasons that people should want to study the first South Dakota Volunteers. And you can do a lot of that studying here at the Historical Society.
Right. Yes, you can. As I said, we've got several things about them in the archives, a few things about them in the museum. The Historical Society, early in its history, put out a call for artifacts. And the veterans of the 1st South Dakota responded with a great deal of material. So probably that group of artifacts was probably the largest single collection for quite some time into the 40s and 50s when other things began to be donated and other calls for artifacts were done. So, in fact, the Society has only done, I was told the other day by David Grabitsky, that Society's done 3 major calls for artifacts, this being the first one. Another call for artifacts from Vietnam War veterans, and then another call for artifacts about those who might have materials related to women's suffrage and women getting the vote in South Dakota in the early 20th century, all the campaigns that were done for that. So it is kind of surprising when you walk in and talk to the curators and they, you know, say, give me all or show me all the stuff from the Philippine War. It's a remarkable and very eclectic group of things to include musical instruments and so forth that were brought home.
Yeah, I think the Fight and First are a real point of pride for South Dakotans and certainly the South Dakota National Guard.
Yeah, definitely the way the governor acquitted himself, the decisions that he made, putting his own mouth where his money was and vice versa, shoring up the lack of ability from the War Department to do its obligations and to meet its obligations for these soldiers amidst a very tenuous political hold that he had on the governorship and so forth. Lee's an impressive guy in that respect, certainly, as is Frost and Riggs too. All the soldiers seem to acquit themselves well. Well, maybe not the 4 deserters, but I'd like to know their story.
Right.
There's 4 stories there that I'm sure are pretty interesting, but those will have to be researched by other folks at other times, I guess. Maybe we'll be able to find out more about that later when people get into that.
Yeah, absolutely.
But I think, too, you can see more broadly how the state equips itself, or the 1st South Dakota equips itself, amidst a war that starts with a great deal of popular support and it ends far less popular. But nevertheless, the support for the troops themselves always remained. So, well, Braden, thanks a lot for joining me here and walking through the 1st South Dakota and its history, and we'll see you around.
Yeah, see you next time.
We'd like to thank Howard and Dorothy Gruver for their passion for history and the support of the South Dakota State Historical Society. It's through gifts such as theirs that we're able to tell South Dakota's history.
When a tornado hits a town, I've never been able to figure out which houses were the Democrats or the Republicans or the Libertarians. I never knew who the Norwegians were, the Swedes, or the Czechoslovakians, or the Germans. Of course, everybody wants to point out who the Irish are, but other than that...
History 605 is produced by the South Dakota State Historical Society, and its audio engineer is the amazing Kevin Larson. We'd like to thank our partner, South Dakota Public Broadcasting, and most importantly, we'd like to thank you for listening. Please rate us on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you listen to fine podcasts. We'll be back in a couple weeks with another episode of History 605.